May it please the court, my name is Arthur Trainer and I represent the petitioners in this matter, the United Mine Workers of America. I'm here before you today because the final rule of the Mine Safety and Health Administration requiring underground refuge chambers is contrary to statute and it is arbitrary and capricious. Now these legal deficiencies render the rule fatally flawed, but what I'd like to draw your attention to today is that these flaws could be fatal to miners as well. Where MSHA abandons the expert conclusion that an effective training regime requires hands-on training, repeated quarterly and without explanation, supplants that conclusion with an ineffective training regime, a demonstrably ineffective training regime, MSHA violates the law and unreasonably jeopardizes miners' lives. In the 2006 Miner Act, Congress created a new office within NIOSH, the Office of Mine Safety and Health, tasked with conducting research and producing a report into refuge chambers. And in that same enactment, Congress directed MSHA to provide a response to the report, describing agency action to be taken based upon the report. Now, in the 2008 Consolidated Appropriations Act, Congress reiterated its intention that agency action requiring underground refuge chambers be based upon the report, where it explicitly directed MSHA to finalize regulations consistent with the report.
Why did you put that in a footnote?
Your Honor, when I first looked at this case, I focused on Section 13 of the Miner Act. The Miner Act is the act that was passed in the wake of three disasters that I felt contained most of the direction to MSHA. And then I noticed that the 2008 Consolidated Appropriations Act more directly stated Congress's intent. So it can be looked at here as a reiteration of Congress's intent. The 2008 Appropriations Act, I should say, could be looked at as a reiteration of Congress's intent in Section 13 of the Miner Act, but it also on its own has force as a standalone enactment, and I explain that more thoroughly in my reply.
There's no discussion of the import of Appropriations Acts. I mean, we have some cases for the proposition that they only apply during the year of the appropriation.
And I've looked into those cases, and they do apply during the year of this, during the year of the appropriation. And this, the proposed rule in this case and the final rule were both promulgated during 2008 while the Appropriations Act was in effect. And in fact, the 2008 Consolidated Appropriations Act provided a date certain by which MSHA should promulgate and finalize the rules. The rule was to be finalized by December 31st, 2008, and that's exactly what happened. So it certainly did apply in this case. Now, I'd like to say that to arrive at the conclusion in their report that miners should receive hands-on training quarterly.
Okay, could I ask you a question about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the NIOSH report, and this is Joint Appendix 109?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where in the second paragraph?
If you could just give me one quick second.
Sure.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
This is the December 2007 NIOSH report.
Yes.
All right, so it starts out by saying NIOSH research indicates, and then at page 111 of the joint appendix, we have something that is the NIOSH docket 125?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the relationship between these two documents?
109 is the report.
Yes.
It's the training recommendations in the report, and that's the report that Congress directed NIOSH to provide to MSHA.
Right.
Directed MSHA to provide a response to. And then 111 is from the administrative record. It's NIOSH's summary of the research underlying the conclusion in their report that you see on 109.
So is it part of the report that was submitted to Congress?
No, the report submitted to Congress
is
109,
only,
and then the right. 111 is NIOSH's own summary of the research that underlie their recommendation they made for quarterly hands-on training.
And that's the recommendation on 109?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And the recommendation on 109 says that miners should receive hands-on training quarterly. And the experts at NIOSH, in order to arrive at this conclusion that hands-on training is required for an effective training regime, reviewed many studies, but one study, the primary study they reviewed, measured miner proficiency in a six-step task by comparing a group of miners who received annual training against a group of miners who received quarterly training. And this is hands-on training. We're talking about apples-to-apples comparison with regard to the type of training.
That's as opposed to this expectations training?
Well, Expectations, I'm not talking now about expectations and decision-making training.
Is that the basic distinction between the two types of training? There's hands-on training and expectations.
And then there's
training.
A third type, decision-making training. Now, the report recommends that all three of them be conducted quarterly, but I'm focusing primarily on the hands-on motor task training.
Okay, so now, so I know you're moving fast because of your limited time, but...
Yes, thank you.
On page 109, are you reading that last sentence to mean that everything NEOSH is recommending?
If you would...
Quarterly?
Yeah, well, that is the recommendation. If they say expectations training, these training components should be included with the other training. But I'm focusing on the hands-on task training, which is how to use the component. It's the most important task. Now, really, you can look at it like this. Miners will receive hands-on training. NIOSH wants it done quarterly. And the expectations training element really says that it should be done under simulated emergency conditions. And the decision-making...
So in the final rule...
Yes.
Now I'm at JA-74.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where there are all these references to the final rule, section 75.1504.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they talk about quarterly training.
Now, if I can... I think I'm anticipating your question, and there... What MSHA has required for quarterly training is not hands-on motor task training that NIOSH recommends. What they've done is they require hands-on training only annually, and their quarterly training consists of a mere paper review of the steps necessary to operate a refuge chamber.
And we know that. I know that's what the brief of the agency says, but looking at the final rule, mm-hmm. we know that because...
It would take me a minute to find the text of the rule,
right.
But I guarantee you that is undisputed. That the final rule...
All right, if you look at column B on 74, and back to Judge Ginsburg's point, the final rule, it says, like the proposal, adopts a training approach that consists of both quarterly training and drills under 1504B, and annual expectations training, i.e. simulated hands-on training, under 54C.
And that statement sort of fudges over the
That's
differences
what I'm trying
here.
To understand.
And I can just get to that very directly. And there's no dispute as to what training is required under the regulation. The MSHA has only required on a quarterly basis that miners review the procedures that are required to deploy and use the chamber. They require hands-on training in those procedures only annually. So they basically said, we'll require the hands-on training that NIOSH said should be done quarterly, but we'll do it annually, and we can supplement that hands-on component by requiring just a paper review quarterly. But there's no evidence in the record to suggest that that would be effective. That, in fact, and NIOSH, MSHA has argued that it simply modified the NIOSH expert's conclusion as to what constitutes effective training. And MSHA argues that even though it doesn't require quarterly hands-on training, it can supplement that training with the paper review, which on page 74, where we were earlier, MSHA recognizes could be accomplished. Miners could comply with that requirement by simply handing, I'm sorry, mine operators could comply with that requirement by simply handing miners a copy of the chamber manufacturer's operator's manual. That's what we're talking about, what MSHA has required in their final rule. And this is exactly what the NIOSH experts told MSHA is not effective. This is exactly what the NIOSH experts told MSHA not to do. And if you look again at page 111, the summary of their training, the NIOSH experts state, quote, trainers ought not to rely solely on verbal or printed instructions. At a minimum, miners should be given a chance to visit a chamber, be talked through the steps involved in its operation, and simulate activating the various controls while demonstrating that they have heard and understood key components.
So when the final rule refers to quarterly training and drills, it's still not talking about hands-on training.
It's only talking about hands-on training. Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. The only hands-on training they require is annual hands-on training. They do not require quarterly hands-on training. They just substitute, when it comes to deployment and use of a refuge chamber, they only require this paper review I discussed. And I'd like to get back to the study I was referring to earlier that underlies the NIOSH expert's conclusion. And it's in that study, The NIOSH reviewed the people conducting the study measured minor proficiency in a six-step skill, a survival skill, by comparing a group of minors who received annual training and a group of minors who received quarterly training. This is hands-on training. Now, the group of minors who received annual training, at the end of 1 year, only 10% of that group were proficient in the tasks on which they were trained. By contrast, at the end of 1 year, 70% of the group who received the quarterly training were proficient. Now, MSHA completely ignores this finding in their final rule, and they completely abandon the expert recommendation that was promulgated in accordance with this finding. And referring to this study, the 70% versus 10% study, the NIOSH experts wrote in that training summary on 111 that it, quote, confirmed what is known empirically about all motor tasks. Initial instruction should involve hands-on practice, which must be repeated in order to maintain proficiency. People learn by doing. In fact, that's what they say. You must repeat that hands-on element if minors are going to retain the information. That's what the studies show. Now, MSHA has provided literally no explanation for its decision to allow hands-on training only once a year. They're silent on this. They cite no studies nor any piece of evidence whatsoever that's contrary to the NIOSH expert findings. They simply invoke agency knowledge and expertise without an explanation at all of what knowledge they're referring to or how their expertise has been applied. This is not legally sufficient, and unless this court remands the rule to MSHA to correct this problems, minors' lives will be in danger. They will receive ineffective training, and their lives will be in danger. And to illustrate...
Let's pause for 1 second.
Yes, sir.
This is not on the question you're on now, which is on arbitrariness, but rather on the question you started with, which is whether it was consistent with the statute. What do you make of this letter from NIOSH saying that the proposed rule is consistent? The proposed rule is also hands-on annual, right?
Training provisions in the proposed and final rule are identical.
So what do you make of this statement at, I think it's JA 144, that the proposed rule is consistent with NIOSH findings as presented in its research report to Congress?
Well, Your Honor, I think here NIOSH in their comments is mistaken. And whether NIOSH, in these comments, NIOSH explained discrepancies between the volume recommendation and the proposed rules volume provisions, but they don't directly address training. And in any event, whether or not NIOSH is correct here, in Nuclear Energy Institute, this case was faced with a similar circumstance. And, the answer here is that whether the rule is consistent with the expert recommendation is a matter of statutory interpretation for the court, because what I was referring to earlier goes not only to the arbitrary and capricious argument, it also underlies the consistent with argument to the extent that everything I was saying shows that MSHA has abandoned the expert recommendation, the expert conclusion, and it has supplanted it with an ineffective training regime. And under Nuclear Energy Institute, the rule at issue there was set aside on those grounds, under Chevron. So
let me just ask you a question, though, about the report or the comments that Judge Garland referred you to.
Yes, Your Honor.
I wonder whether what the comments say is they say, if you look at JA 144, it says, and if appropriate training is provided. And then in the final paragraph, they say, NIOSH supports the interior volume requirements in the proposed rule. The second paragraph is all about...
That's correct, Your
so
Honor.
You might not have to go quite as far as you did by saying that their comments are wrong.
Assuming arguendo that you take their...
arguendo.
Yes, I should have said that. But you're right, Your Honor, that they do say if appropriate training is provided, which is obviously conditional. And
That's what I was trying to... Are you interpreting the first paragraph as not relating to the training?
That's correct. I mean, they do reference.
You answered me first. That's why.
Well, Your Honor, I'll be quite honest with you.
You don't know what
I did not. No. I do understand what you're saying, but I did not.
No, you don't understand what they're saying.
Well, I understand what they're saying is that they generally think that the rule is consistent with their report, but I think they overlook training. And actually, it's Judge Rogers points it out to me for the first time that they write if appropriate training is provided. So it's conditional. It's consistent if appropriate training is provided, they're saying. But look, what I looked at, I didn't even look at it. I mean, I didn't even look at it in that level of detail, because Nuclear Energy Institute presents a similar circumstance where the National Academy of Sciences said that EPA could promulgate a rule consistent with its recommendations if it tailored it to meet policy objectives. And the court said it rejected any argument based on the NAS's comments there, saying, and I have the quote here, and I think that would be most helpful. The court said it deemed those comments from the National Academy of Sciences of little importance. And the statements that EPA was free to adopt an inconsistent standard that best meets EPA policy goals, in response to that, the court said that this court, not the Academy, is charged with determining whether EPA has exercised its rulemaking discretion in compliance with this statute. And I think that that particular part of the holding in NEI is directly on point here. It's really up to you to determine whether consistent with that statutory obligation has been met. And it hasn't.
I had one quick question, if I may.
Please.
On the reduction of the volume.
Yes, Your Honor.
The preamble to the proposed rule, and I gather from the final rule, the agency statement at the public hearings, asked for comments on the proposed requirement, at least insofar as a 15 square foot of floor space and 60 cubic feet of volume per person. All right, so they asked for comments on those two things, both the 60 and the 15. All right,
where
they
are
did.
You?
I mean, okay. if you look at JA-21 of the proposed rule, they did ask for those comments.
Well, what I understood
and
is...
They say in the final rule that they did. And so my question is, did your client have any opportunity to comment, even informally, once it became clear that the agency was considering reducing the volume requirement?
Well, we had an opportunity to comment on the initial reduction of the expert's conclusion, which they said was just a starting point. We had an opportunity to comment on whether the reduction from 85, I believe it was, to 60 was, okay with us, and we did comment on that.
Right.
And now but the problem is we had no opportunity to comment on a further reduction from 60 to 30.
Why is that the date of the various comments proposing that further reduction shows that they were filed before your comments were filed?
I have, to be honest, Your Honor, I have not noticed
They're all laid out there in the docket, and the manufacturers of the refuges and so on, two or three parties, suggested something along the lines of what was ultimately adopted. Then you came in with your comment and said 85 really should be kept, you shouldn't go to 60. I take it as a fortiori that you mean therefore you shouldn't go below 60 as well, so
right.
I don't think you lost any opportunity.
Well, let me tell you the opportunity we did lose here, Your Honor. It was reduced from 85 to 60, but we, because MSHA said that the problem with low mine heights, which the other parties addressed in their comments, could be addressed by increasing length and width, we had no idea. There was no notice to us that that 60 cubic foot reduction, which was already a reduction from the recommendation, that it could be reduced, it could be slashed in half to 30 cubic feet, which raises a whole new host of problems, including the fact that it doesn't allow miners the space necessary to perform essential survival tasks that MSHA has recognized are essential, including shelter repair and first aid. You have to imagine miners laying in a coffin-like chamber where they only have what 30 cubic feet looks like. It's 6 feet, that's as tall as I am, I'm 6'1 actually, 6 feet by 2.5 feet wide by 2 feet tall. That's what the final rule for low coal, for the low mine heights, allows for these miners.
Just pause for one second. The height, I take it, is out of anyone's control, though.
You're
right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, that's, that aspect of the constraint is a constraint that is not anybody's fault. Is that right?
Well,
I understand the point about the remainder of the dimensions, but I take it you aren't.
Yeah, you're correct. That height has to be reduced.
That's caused by how high the coal seam is and how much extra space you need to fit in one of these.
You're 100% correct, Your Honor.
So, just to ask again the question, I think that Judge Rogers was asking. We received on July 14th the comments that are relevant to this statement, which I take it you received also as part of the appendix, I guess. And then Judge Ginsburg asked, well, these do propose even smaller than 60 cubic feet volume. So why didn't you respond to these comments, I guess, put it that way? In other words, somebody is proposing, there's a number of these proposals to go as far as they ultimately went. So these people at least thought that was open. Why didn't you respond to them?
What we understood was that those commenters were talking about reducing the height, but we always understood that the volume dimension would remain the same because
the first
length
comments,
and width would be
the first comments from Jack Kennedy Metal Products and Buildings, July 17, 08. This is a shelter manufacturer, and they're recommending 15 cubic feet in some circumstances and 20 in others. Then Randall Harris, engineering advisor, West Virginia, MSHA, recommends 30 cubic feet. That's on August 1st. There are a couple others. Your comments are filed on August 15th.
Oh, I understand what you're asking.
Right.
The thing is that we were looking toward what MSHA said they would do about the low coal problem, and they said that they would increase length and width. And I think that this, what fits in nicely here is the Holding and Fertilizer Institute, where the court held that you can't bootstrap notice from comment. There were some commenters who were saying there should be no minimum volume requirement, and we didn't think to address every one of these commenters' concerns because we were addressing what MSHA said. And what MSHA said is that if we're going to reduce further, we're going to increase length and width so that miners still have the volume necessary to perform these essential tests. We were astonished when, without subsequent notice and comment, they reduced this volume requirement to the incredibly small levels where it's reduced, where miners are unable to perform essential tasks. That's the prejudice here to the United Mine Workers of America, is that we had no opportunity to comment on or to address the fact that this constrained volume would leave miners unable to perform tasks necessary for survival. That's the whole argument there. I mean, I couch it in terms of logical outgrowth, I couch it in terms of the various standards, but really the argument is we were prejudiced because we were talking about, in our comments, the reduction from 85 to 60, which we had problems there because about the mental well-being of miners. That actually, you know, you've heard about that in Chile now, but we never really got to get into much more serious issues presented by the final rules, further reduction.
You're way over time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. If I can,
Nope, you're way over time.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Ed Waldman. I represent the Secretary of Labor and the Mine Safety and Health Administration. I'd like to point out that in its reply brief, the union conceded its statutory argument with regard to the volume provision. And with regard to the statutory argument concerning
Section 13.
Yes.
Of the Miners Act.
Correct. And the Appropriations Act as well.
You think they conceded the Appropriations Act?
Yes. That's the way I read their brief.
Okay.
I ask you about, I mean, the place we've been focusing here is on the question of the hands-on training and whether it's arbitrary and capricious a decision. So you have NIOSH report emphasizing the importance of hands-on training, emphasizing studies that show quarterly is good and annual is not good because of the fall-off. In your proposed rule, the preamble again talks about the need for hands-on, and that is the preamble. No, but nonetheless, the rule itself, and you'll correct me, I suppose, if I'm wrong, the rule itself, as just represented, doesn't have hands-on training quarterly, only yearly. So could you show me where in either the proposed rule or the final rule the agency addresses this evidence and concludes that hands-on isn't necessary? That is, on what basis does it conclude that hands-on yearly but supplemented by quarterly paper training is enough?
The agency relied in that conclusion on the studies that were discussed earlier that showed the drop-off.
So that would all suggest you need a quarterly, which they didn't do.
No, those reports are to the effect that if you have hands-on training and then you provide nothing else, you'll have the drop-off as much as maybe 80% over 90 days and all the way down to 10% over the course of a year. But those studies didn't address at all hands-on training on an annual basis that would be supplemented by quarterly review of procedures for deployment and use. That's not in the studies at all. I mean, so what MSHA concluded based on the studies was that, yes, there's a need for hands-on training. Yes, that hands-on training has to be repeated. But there was no evidence in the record that the hands-on training had to be repeated quarterly. In fact, the NIOSH research that underlies the NIOSH report that's been discussed earlier, that research, and this is a joint appendix, page 111.
Yes, that's about right. We were there earlier.
Yeah, it's actually at the top of page 112. It says the optimum intervals for retraining on a refuge chamber are not known.
Right, I understand that, but I guess the question is what you've just said I don't see in the rule. That is, I don't see them saying that, you know, these studies were only about, I understand what you're saying, that the studies were, as you say, but I don't see them saying that quarterly paper is enough and that annual on hands-on is enough because of some other study. That is, how do you get from, you have studies that show that if you do it quarterly, and it says, NIOSH suggests that they be done quarterly. There's no doubt about that, right? That the hands-on be done quarterly. So what is the explanation for why the decision was made to do it annually? Now, I suppose one explanation would be cost too much, or one explanation would be, I don't know, confuses people. But those explanations aren't in here. There really is no explanation for why they went to annual. Is there? Is there an explanation?
The explanation that's given in the preamble is the Secretary's knowledge and experience.
Where is that? Where does it say the Secretary's knowledge and experience?
74.
I think that is,
MSHA's knowledge and experience.
Yes.
But it's not at all clear what experience we're talking about here.
Well, I'm sorry.
We're on page 74.
Based on Belize quarterly training and drills together with is reasonable approach. So what is that knowledge and experience?
Yeah.
Okay. If you go back to that NIOSH research summary, it indicates, and I'm back to the page, the top of 112. The next sentence after the one I read earlier is, a reasonable approach, however, would be to integrate instruction on the refuge chamber into the emergency mine evacuation training and drills that are mandated to be held quarterly. It's a logical fit and would provide repetition throughout the year. So essentially what NIOSH is saying is that in the absence of any evidence given what the proper interval should be, what we are recommending is that this refuge chamber training should be integrated into the existing emergency mine evacuation training rule that the Secretary's already got on the books. And in fact, the Secretary took that suggestion and did integrate the training.
Yeah, but it's clear that their recommendation has to do with the hands-on, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so my question is why the NIOSH wasn't saying it would be reasonable to it may well be reasonable to do hands-on different than quarterly.
It might be,
but the question is, where is the explanation for why it's reasonable to do it less than quarterly?
All the preamble says is the Secretary's knowledge and experience.
Well, is there anything in the record? Are there any, for example, with respect to the volume, you had comments talking about why the volume was a problem, and moving things around, et cetera. Are there any comments in the record on this training issue? that you know, where somebody objected to the quarterly hands-on and said, you know, we don't really need it quarterly, we can do it annually?
Yes, there are plenty of those. Obviously, that's not what the Secretary cited in the preamble. And I think it really goes back to the fact that, you know, because NIOSH is recommendation is that the Secretary should integrate this new training into training that the Secretary already has on the books. And then the Secretary says in the preamble, based on our knowledge and experience, the knowledge and experience, I think, is it's relatively clear, or at least discernible, that they are that the knowledge and experience being referred to is the knowledge and experience with respect to that regulation that's already on the book governing emergency mine evacuation training. And if the question is, how is it best to integrate the new training into the existing training, obviously the Secretary is in a better position, based on her knowledge and experience, to do that than NIOSH is. And that's the way I read what the preamble is saying when it's saying the Secretary's knowledge and experience.
Let me ask you back on J74 in columns B to C, where it's talking about quarterly training and drills together with annual expect training is a reasonable approach. And it says during each quarterly drill, miners would be required to locate, this is at the top of column C, locate the refuge alternatives and review the deployment and use. And that sort of phrase is repeated. And you read that as clearly excluding hands-on training. Now, I mean, your brief says that, I understand, but I just wanted to be clear about the language, and counsel for petitioners says that's correct as well.
I think that is correct.
All right.
But if I could return to the knowledge and experience, again, I mean...
It can't be enough to just say we rely on our knowledge experience. Then we would never...
Right.
You know, no agency would ever lose because
that's
they would
right.
say knowledge and experience and not tell us what the knowledge and experience was.
That's right.
And what I think what's problematic in this case and what I'm asking you about is you have... The only thing we have in the record is NIOSH's studies, which involved hands-on, quarterly, and a fall off from that. Now, I appreciate the argument you're making, which is that, well, those studies didn't have anything after that. And if NIOSH had, and if the Secretary had said, and therefore we think this is not necessary at all, and we have some other knowledge and experience, but they didn't say that, and they didn't say what the other knowledge and experience was. Is there any knowledge and experience that you know about of how hands-on training for a quarter and paper for the rest is just as good as hands-on every quarter?
The knowledge and experience that I believe the Secretary was referring to is that in the emergency mine evacuation rule that already existed, this full-scale hands-on dress rehearsal type training, which the Secretary calls expectations training, but it includes the hands-on and the decision-making and the everything. That training in the existing emergency mine evacuation rule is given on an annual basis. That's in 75.1504C. And so the Secretary, based on her knowledge and experience, decided that, well, it makes sense to integrate this full dress rehearsal type training into this already existing rule by requiring it on an annual basis.
So there isn't anything, I mean, when you say this is our experience, since we have no experience with anything else, they're not comparing it to anything, right? So you're saying that they have annual hands-on total evacuation, but they don't know whether that's better than annual, than semi-annual or quarter annual, because they don't have the others. So there's nothing for that, there's no study or example or comparison, and that's what I'm sort of asking about. And I can also, I guess, assume that quarterly total evacuations would be extremely disruptive and expensive, while quarterly hands-on of the kind we're talking about here would not be the same. I assume that's right.
I assume that's right, too. The Secretary did not provide that as an explanation in the preamble. What the Secretary relied on is her knowledge and experience, and I will admit that that's a rather cursory explanation, but I submit that the agency's decision-making path is reasonably discernible in light of what's said in the NIOSH research report and the fact that this rule is being integrated into a pre-existing mine emergency evacuation rule, which requires the annual full dress rehearsal training, which requires that training only on an annual basis.
Well, let me ask you, the NIOSH report you keep referring to at 112, right?
Correct.
The optimum intervals for retraining on a refuge chamber are not known.
Okay.
A reasonable approach, however, would be to integrate instruction on the refuge chamber into the emergency mine evacuation training and drills that are mandated to be quarterly. So if it's integrated into the quarterly exercise, doesn't that mean it would occur quarterly?
It sure does. But here, I think,
so and knowledge and experience has got to explain away something that seems to be directly contradictory.
Okay, in the emergency mine evacuation rule, there is hands-on training that's given quarterly. And this gets into semantics, really, between the difference between hands-on training and expectations training. And what's required on a quarterly basis in the mine emergency evacuation rule is donning and doffing self-contained self-rescuer units. It's in other words, putting them on and taking them off and all the procedures involved in doing that, but it's not actually using them, let alone using them in simulated, realistic mine emergency situations such as smoke and whatnot. So that's what's required quarterly is simply donning and doffing these self-contained self-rescuer units. What's required annually in this rule is a full-scale, realistic, simulated emergency in which they not only have to put on the self-contained self-rescuers, but they have to use them in smoky conditions, and they actually have to breathe through them so they understand what it feels like.
What's the annual? What's the hands-on with respect to the rescue chamber?
The hands-on is quarterly.
No.
Oh, what's the hands-on? The hands-on with respect to the rescue chamber is physically locating. The refuge chambers during a mine evacuation drill, and locating them on the various mine maps, and to review the procedures.
NIOSH's proposal of quarterly hands-on, what would it involve? If you had adopted that, what would that have meant?
I understand NIOSH to be recommending the full-scale, simulated, realistic deployment and use of a refuge chamber.
Right. How is that closer to donning and doffing, or is that closer? Is that closer to the complete evacuation with smoke?
It's much closer to the complete evacuation with smoke.
Huh. Doesn't sound like it from the description here. In this annual training, is there smoke in these evacuation chambers? The annual hands-on training that you're talking about. That is in the final rule.
Yes, smoke is required to be used in the annual evacuation training. Correct.
The description at the bottom of JA111 sounds a lot more like donning and doffing. It says, at a minimum, miners should be given a chance to visit a chamber, be talked through the steps involved in its operation, and simulate activating the various controls. That sounds, quite a lot like they should be given the hood, they should put it on, they should have a chance to, figure out how it works.
Correct.
Well, so that sounds...
And that...
That sounds more like something different than your total evacuation experience.
That's correct, and
so
I think
that. So therefore, that sounds like it should be done quarterly, not annually.
And the rule does really provide something very close to that quarterly, because the miners are given a chance to visit the chamber. They have to physically locate it. So they're obviously, you know, at the site of the chamber. They are be talked through the steps involved in its operation. They're being instructed, either verbally or in writing, the procedures for deploying and using the refuge chamber. As far as simulating the various controls, that's where you can't do that in the quarterly training, because that would require actually breaking the seal and going into the unit, the refuge chamber. And that's something that's not supposed to be done unless it's absolutely necessary, which is why at least the preamble talks about training units being available.
I don't understand. The rule talks about these refuge chambers have to be accessible to inspectors. So I assume they inspect them without breaking through the roof.
That's correct. They don't enter.
So you could have hands-on training where the miner goes into the chamber without breaking the roof.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
No, I don't think we need to elaborate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Waldman, I think we have your argument.
Thank you.
Trainer, will give you 1 minute.
I think you were right on track when you were discussing the nature of the quarterly hands-on training that we're talking about here. It's not the full expectations training that needs to be done quarterly, although that's what NIOSH recommends. But our challenge to the rule is that they don't even go through the hands-on simulating the procedures. The repetition, the physical repetition that all the studies identify as necessary for miners to acquire proficiency. And Judge Rogers, you are correct.
But are you talking about breaking the roof and all of that?
No, Judge Rogers, you were correct in noting that, first of all, this is the first time I hear it because they didn't explain that in the rules. But I just want to point out that you had, I think, alluded to practice chambers, and that's what the rule would contemplate here, and that many operators already have chambers to be used for training purposes, and there's no evidence that any seals would need to be broken to actually simulate all of the 18 steps necessary to get into a chamber. The study that I referred to earlier that showed the discrepancy between miners trained annually and quarterly being 10% to 70%, that involved a 6-step procedure.
Just didn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. That involved a 6-step procedure, where annual training only results in 10% proficiency and quarterly results in 70%. Those studies were done on a 6-step procedure, and getting into a refuge chamber, deploying, using it, purging the air, and establishing a breathable environment, that is an 18-step procedure, far more complicated. So there's every reason to believe that miners need more frequent training if they're going to be effective in performing those tasks in the event of an emergency. And I see that I'm over my time, and I thank you very much for your
time. I'm sure I understood what you started with. The quarterly training that you are proposing and or you're objecting to them not doing involves training in a practice chamber, not going into the mine and finding the actual locations?
No, it would involve going into a mine and finding the actual locations, and that part of it they got right in their training regime. But what they don't have is the hands-on component of simulating doing those 18 steps.
That wouldn't be done in some actual place within the mine. That would be done in a practice chamber?
It could be done in a practice chamber. It very well could be done someplace in the actual mine. I have no knowledge about seals being broken or anything like that, and there's no reference to that anywhere in the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Walton. The case is submitted.